Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Cafe Scientifique. My name is Zachary Weber. I am the Education Coordinator of Adult Programs here at Carnegie Science Center.
In a couple of seconds, I'll introduce our speaker. She'll speak for about 50 minutes or so. Then we'll take a quick 5 or 10 minute break, give people a chance to stretch your legs, use the restroom, whatever you need to do, and then we'll regroup back here after for our Q&A time. And Q&A time is my favorite part of Cafe Sci, so make sure you stick around for that. And I'll go over a little bit of how we'll structure that before we begin. All right. So without any more delays, allow me to introduce our guest for this evening. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Allison Barth. Dr. Barth is an associate professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at Carnegie Mellon University, where she studies the organization and plasticity of neocortical circuits in rodents. Her work centers on how synapses are altered by behavioral experience, where she uses neurophysiological recordings, transgenic mice, and electron mice microscopy to understand brain function. These introductions always have so many big words. I apologize. Dr. Barth is the recipient of numerous awards, including the Research Award for Innovation in Neuroscience from the Society for Neuroscience, the McKnight Foundation, the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation, and has been a Sloan Foundation Fellow. She holds a patent for the FOS-GFP transgenic mouse and is an inventor on multiple applications for other neuroscience-related methods and treatments. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Allison Barth.
Thanks. So can everybody hear me? Is this... Okay, I'll move it up. How about this? There, better? Okay. So it's a pleasure to be here. This is actually the first time I've been to Cafe Sci, and so I know many of you are regulars, and I hope that I can live up to your previous experiences here, which I have heard are really excellent. I'm coming to you from Carnegie Mellon, where I'm on the faculty in the biology department. And I'm going to talk to you today about some of my work and also the work of others, really sort of state-of-the-art of memory studies in terms of looking at representations for learning and memory in the brain. And as a biologist, I'm really interested in the cells and the synapses, the stuff of the brain, which is really quite distinct from psychology. I'm interested in how genes and proteins make cells and synapses between cells, and how those can be modified by experience. And I should say at the outset, I think one of the reasons that I'm interested particularly in learning is because, and memory, is because I personally feel like I have a terrible memory. And you know, one of the things that a lot of education does, it sort of weeds out people who can't memorize things very well. And as a biology major, many of my classmates were going to med school, and they were fantastic at memorizing things. And I was miserable at memorizing things, and I'm still not that great about memorizing things. But it goes to show that there's a lot of other ways to use your mind without necessarily memorizing everything. And I'm going to tell you also today about some strategies for memorization that are ancient and actually very effective. So... Let me start off by making a distinction between learning and memory. And in my area, we often use them interchangeably. You have to learn to be able to remember, okay? And there are many different types of memory. What I have shown you up here is somebody learning how to ride a bike. Most of you know how to ride a bike. You learned how to ride a bike, and it's very hard to forget how to ride a bike. Even when you haven't ridden a bike, some of you probably haven't gotten on a bike for 20 years, you can still remember how to ride a bike. And that type of memory is a sort of a motor memory. It's a kind of a procedural memory. But of course, we have a lot of other types of memory, right? We have episodic memory, which are things that have happened to us. Where were you when the Twin Towers fell? We have semantic memory for names and places. So I just met a couple people, and I hope that I can remember their names in a few days. I certainly think I could remember their faces, perhaps, before I could remember their names, right? And then there's an implicit kind of memory, and this is sort of a procedural memory. So this is a kind of implicit learning. And so just because you can't tell somebody how to ride a bike doesn't mean that you don't know how to do it. So there's a lot of things that are encoded in our neural circuits that aren't available to somebody who asks about them. But we can show that we can remember things. And that will be really important when we start to think about how we can investigate the biological mechanisms for memory, because there's only so much we're going to be able to do in people. And so I'm going to start off by telling you about some studies in people and then give you an idea of how we are beginning to investigate these questions in model organisms and specifically in rodents. So this is a picture of really, I think, one of the heroes of early memory studies. This fellow is named Wilder Penfield. He was a neurologist, an American who practiced in Canada, and I believe the Canadians really claimed him as their own. For a while, he was described as the Canada's greatest living citizen. And he was a neurologist. He was interested in brain malfunction. But he was also a scientist and really studied with some of the best neuroscientists of his day. And in his studies, as he was carrying out a treatment for various kinds of neurological disorders, he made some incredibly interesting observations about the nature of memory. And I'm going to tell you about some of those, and I'll read you actually some of his work because they're incredibly provocative. So in some of his studies to treat patients with epilepsy. Now, epilepsy can be treated. There's a number of different kinds of treatments. In fact, many people who have seizure disorders will spontaneously get better. Some can be treated by medication. But in some cases, in some severe cases, their treatments of the pharmaceutical treatments are ineffective. And one of the best treatments is actually surgical treatments. Has a great outcome, but you lose brain tissue. And so it's often used, even today, as a last resort. Wilder Penfield used neurosurgery as a way to treat patients with epilepsy. And while they were on the table, he took the opportunity to carry out some very specific studies. So this is what the human brain looks like during this sort of surgical operation. So the skull has been removed, there's a craniotomy, and there's an opening made in the skull, and you reveal a large portion of brain tissue. Now this might be only a few centimeters across, and in fact, you often expose a large portion of the brain because you want to figure out where the epileptic focus is, what part of the tissue is particularly behaving abnormally, and you also want to make sure that you don't remove something that's really critical to our sense of self and our sense of personhood. And specifically, what you really want to avoid are areas involved with language. Okay, so if you treat somebody's seizure disorder, but you take away their ability to understand or generate language, oftentimes people would prefer to have the seizure disorder. And so what he did during these operations, these were people who were suffering terribly from seizure disorders, was that he took the opportunity. And these patients were awake. They were not in pain. They were anesthetized so that they did not feel pain. However, they were only lightly anesthetized so that they could still respond to questions that were being asked. And what Penfield and his coworkers did was to introduce an electrode in various positions along the surface of the brain and to provide a very small electric current and to ask then the patient what they felt or saw or experienced during this episode of microstimulation. So this is a tiny electrical shock, doesn't damage the brain at all, but it had very, very reproducible outcomes in terms of the person's experience and what they would report. And so they would move this electrode across the surface of the brain to multiple locations and ask, what are you experiencing at this time? And so, for example, there were things that they never saw, and there were things that they frequently saw. Now, keep in mind, all these studies were carried out. This is the surface of the brain. This is what we would see if we took off a portion of the skull. And there's a lot of structures deeper inside the brain that they didn't investigate. But here are some examples of things that they saw. So this is a particular case It was the case of a 12-year-old boy who suffered from intractable seizures. And this is a schematic of the cerebral cortex. So in reality, the cerebral cortex is full of sulcine gyri, right? It's folded. This has been sort of smoothed out in his diagram. And in the area that I've colored yellow here, this area and this area, they elicited very specific sensations in the back of the brain here. So the eyes would be up front here. This would be the back of the head. Microstimulation back here elicited the sensation of seeing shapes or perhaps lines that were moving across a field or flashes of light or darkness. When they stimulated in this region here, the patient claimed to feel a tingling sensation, perhaps in his lips or his hand. And it was always very somatotopically localized. It wasn't all over his body. It was in the index finger or on his lip. In contrast, when they stimulated some other brain areas, so specifically these areas here, which are near this visual area, the subject claimed to see a very specific image, robbers with guns. And it happened to be that this was an image that often preceded his seizures, and that he could describe these images in great detail. He felt like they were sort of comic book images that were drawn. It was like a recollection. And it was not something that he had never experienced before. It wasn't confabulation of a variety of things that he'd never had any contact with. It was a specific episode or visual memory that had specific parts that he could point to. And these two different locations here yielded the same visual hallucination or this visual memory. In a separate location here along the temporal lobe, when microstimulation was applied to these two different locations, he felt like he experienced hearing a conversation between his mother and his aunt, where his mother was saying, "Come and visit us tonight." And what I think is really interesting about this is that these two locations here are different, are separated by several centimeters, okay? And yet the same auditory recollection was elicited by both positions. Now, the number of neurons in this area is in the millions, okay? But this intervening area, when he stimulated this intervening area, he had a different recollection, and that was, my mother is telling my brother he has his coat on backwards, which I think is kind of funny, right? Because he's a kid, he's a 12-year-old kid, and these were really experiences that he had, vivid auditory recollections. Now, other patients, this is one example here, other patients that underwent this sort of microstimulation procedure would also have very specific auditory recollections, and in fact, you could map this brain area all throughout this region here. And Penfield called it memory cortex. And it was so robust that you could stimulate the same area over and over again and recreate the same auditory memory. My mother, again, telling my aunt to come and visit us. The other, I'm going to read to you what he wrote, because I think that there are elements of this, and these are experiments you can't do any other way. You can't do them in a monkey, you can't do them in a mouse, you can't do them in a cricket. And they reveal something about what the substrates for memory might be. So this is what happened when he underwent this, when these patients underwent this microstimulation. He writes, a familiar experience appears in a patient's consciousness, whether he desires to focus his attention upon it or not. So it's impressed upon them. It's not as though it's something happening in the background. All of a sudden, it captures all of their attention. The subject feels again the emotion which the situation originally produced in him, and he is aware of the same interpretations, true or false, which he gave to the experience in the first place. It is not the exact photographic reproduction of past scenes and events. It is a reproduction of what the patient saw and heard and understood. In many cases, it has been evident that the evoked memory is more detailed than anything the patient could possibly summon for his own consideration. And so these are not memories that you could ask somebody about and have them recreate. In some cases, people could remember the words of songs, complex songs, right? You know, the verses and the chorus, that if you'd asked them to come up with them, they would have been, you know, stuck after the first few words. It is not fused with other similar experiences, differing from normal recollection of the past, where single experiences may be indistinguishable from other similar experiences, right? Driving home from the grocery store, right? You've done it a million times, but you can't remember a single instance of when you did it. They sort of all blur together. In this case, the memories were detailed and specific. The evoked experience was more vivid than an ordinary memory. It was as clear as it would have been 30 seconds after the original experience. And I really, you know, I get chills reading about this because these sorts of experiments that Penfield was doing on these surgical candidates, right, are virtually impossible for us to recreate in any way, and yet they give us a very clear example of what memory could be and what's stored in the circuits of our brains, even without us knowing about it. And this leads us to the question of what's our capacity for memory? And I told you, you know, I feel like I have a terrible memory. And it might be that I think my memory's bad because I've been around people with really great memories. But in fact, it looks like our capacity for memory can be much larger than most of us appreciate. And I want to tell you a story both what you and I could do, even I could do, and then what a normal individual, an otherwise unremarkable individual could do by practicing certain memory techniques. So I'm showing you an example. This was a study that was published about 6 years ago that was about visual recollection. And in this study, the question that they were addressing was, what's our capacity for remembering things? Not that we're struggling to remember, like what day is your coworker's birthday, or what's your cell phone number, which many of us don't know, right? But can you identify something that you've seen before? And not only can you identify it, but if you haven't been actively, you know, there's a lot of things you see all the time, right? If you're not actively struggling to remember that, what's your capacity? And there were some studies done in the 70s that suggested, you know, there may be a few, your capacity for visual memory might be a few hundred images, and it seemed like a lot. In this study, they were testing individuals on a thousand or more images, 2,500 images in some cases. And then they asked individuals to report whether they had seen this before. And they could correctly identify objects from this series of 2,000 images correctly most of the time. And so there were a couple different examples. This is an exemplar. Have you seen something like this before? And after 2,500 images, people could say, yes, I've seen something like that before. That was in the image bank that you showed me. That's extraordinary because they had access to these images for about 3 seconds. 3 seconds an image, 2,000 images. And then you're shown this and you're asked, have you seen that before? Was that in the bank that we showed you? And 13 out of 14 people got it right. The chocolate cake here was 14 out of 14. In this case, I think this is even more extraordinary. These are the same object, and the question was not have you seen it before, but was it in the same state? And so you can see that there are tiny differences between these two objects. This is an abacus, and you can see the beads have been rearranged on this abacus just slightly. And 13 out of 14 people could say that they'd seen this before, but it was in a different state. And that suggests that we are all the time encoding incredibly specific features, not only of our visual world, but also our auditory and our olfactory and our tactile and all our sensory experiences. Okay, so a lot of different types of learning. I want to give you another example of a very impressive type of learning that people can carry out. And this is a type of perceptual learning that's commercially quite important. So these are chicks here. And if you are in the egg industry, one of the things you want to do when you're raising chicks is to keep the females and get rid of the males. Males aren't going to lay eggs. You don't need them. You don't need many of them. And so you don't want to feed them from the beginning because you want to use all your food, right? You want to translate that into hens who will lay eggs. And so an industry has grown up around sexing chickens at very early stages of development, like a day or two after they hatch. So an expert chicken sexer, first of all, it's impossible for any of us who don't do this. It's impossible to tell a male and a female chicken apart, right? There aren't a lot of cues. It's quite ambiguous. It takes several months to learn how to do this. Several months of training. And yet, somebody who's expert at doing this can do 90 in a minute, right? So they're coming down the conveyor belt, and you're looking at them, and you're throwing the males into one bin and the females into another bin. So you can learn very rapidly how to recognize specific cues, right? And you can get better and better and better at it. So these are totally different types of learning. One case, you're really sort of passively just trying to recollect something. That's a bit easier than actually trying to recall something. In another case, you're using perceptual learning to develop an expertise that you can then deploy. Now, there are some strategies by which we can learn how to remember more than, for example, we might normally be able to do in our everyday life. And so I'm going to tell you about an ancient strategy of sequencing objects or items using our really well-developed ability to navigate spatially in our world. So has anyone here heard of a memory palace? So the memory palace is an ancient technique, really thousands of years old, to use a location like your house or any place that you're incredibly familiar with to place objects around that physical location so that you can, in your mind, move through that space and identify those objects and then place them in order. And so you can do this, actually, to sequence dozens and dozens of objects. And you can do this, anybody can do this, to improve their powers of memory, right, of being able to recall lists of items, okay? And so it takes advantage of spatial location. You translate, for example, your car keys into a very salient object, for example, somebody carrying a sword who's standing by your front door, okay? And by doing that with a series of objects, then you can remember all the things you need to take with you when you leave the house in the morning. So I want to just tell you there's a book that describes the experiences of an otherwise normal guy. His name was Joshua Farr, and he just graduated from high school or from college, and he was looking for a job. He was a reporter, and he came across a competition in the World Memory Championships where people were carrying out amazing feats of memory. And I'll give you an example of one of these memory feats. A deck of 52 cards shuffled in a random order. The world memory champion can memorize the order of these cards in 22 seconds. In under 22 seconds. Random order. Flipping through them one time and can memorize the order of these cards in 22 seconds. Joshua Farr, in the course of 1 year, as he was investigating who are these people who participated in these memory championships, in the space of 1 year, he himself became the U.S. memory champion. And he says he did not have any special capacity for memory, but using specific techniques that these memory people who compete in these memory competitions use, he was able to develop this capacity. So what I want to investigate, what I'm interested in, are not what is our capacity for memory, but what is the biological substrate that's critical for memory. And so if I believe that there's a physical substance that's changed in the brain when we learn about something, when we remember something, then we've got to figure out where it is, right? I can't study it if I don't know where it is. And so one of the first questions that we have to address is where do we look, right? And what is going to happen to the brain when learning occurs, when memories are stored? And so, this is a human brain here. One of the best candidates for the storage of memory, especially short-term memory, is in the hippocampus, which is a structure that's deep inside the brain here. Now, Wilder Penfield wasn't stimulating the hippocampus. His electrodes were just on the surface of the brain, just as you saw in the image of the blood vessels and the sulci and gyri of the human brain. But deep inside the brain is a structure called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus, for a lot of reasons, some of which I'll tell you about, has been an excellent candidate as being a substrate where changes in biological cells and synapses are occurring. So let me tell you some of the evidence that makes us think the hippocampus is one place that we should look. This is a fascinating study that was done on people who are expert navigators. And expert, by expert navigators, I mean London cab drivers. So any of you who've looked at a map of London or been to London or have in fact been in any complex city that's older, right, that's not laid out on a grid, like Manhattan, no problem. Pittsburgh, on the other hand, super complicated. And London is even worse. So this is less than a square mile of streets in London. And you can see that there are many streets here that are only a few blocks, that the name changes from one intersection to another. And so this is a tiny fraction of the London map, street map. And in fact, London cab drivers have an enormous task in front of them. Now, maybe things will be different, right? If you have some navigator, you know, you don't need to know anything. You'll just get to look it up and then do what your navigator tells you. But in fact, those tools haven't been available for that long. And in this particular study, they took London cab drivers with at least about 5 years of experience, and they compared them to other people who weren't cab drivers, so people like me, for example. And they looked using magnetic resonance imaging, right, which is a non-invasive way to look inside the skull, to look inside and see what the structure of the brain is like. And they asked, are there differences in the anatomy, the volume, the size of different structures in the brain? And one of the parts of the brain that they were specifically interested in was the hippocampus, which lies in here. Okay, so it's deep within the brain. This is the cerebral cortex out here, the wrinkly stuff on the surface of the brain. That's what we saw over here, right? And we're taking a cross-section like this. And if you look then at the hippocampus, you can draw a box around this anatomical structure, and you can ask, is there something different about this area of the brain that seems to be particularly important for spatial navigation in these expert navigators? And what they found was that the hippocampus in London cab drivers was a little bit smaller at the top and a little bit larger at the back than normal individuals. And so it looked like being an expert navigator was anatomically changing the brain. Okay? There are other pieces of evidence that suggest the hippocampus might be a good place to look. A very famous example is a patient called H.M., who also, unfortunately, suffered from epilepsy. And as a young adult, had a large portion of his brain removed, including both hippocampi, a bilateral resection of the hippocampus. And forever after, H.M. lacked the ability to translate short-term memory into long-term memory. And so you would meet him, you'd introduce yourself, you'd bring him a Coke, you'd talk to him about how his day was, you'd leave the room and return, and 5 minutes later, when you walked in again, he'd have no recollection that he'd ever met you before. And you could go through this 100 times in a day. So there's evidence that the hippocampus is necessary. There's evidence that the hippocampus can be anatomically changed. And there's evidence that other structures in the brain are also required to elicit these memories. Remember, Wilder Penfield wasn't stimulating the hippocampus. And in fact, many people think that long-term storage is occurring in the cerebral cortex, in this part of the brain, this wrinkly surface of the brain. So where are the neurons that encode a specific memory? Where are the neurons that would enable us to recognize something? The hippocampus is a great candidate. One of the issues in studying the hippocampus is that there's an awful lot of neurons there. And if we want to find the cells and see how they're changed by our experiences, we've got to look through 50 million neurons, and that's approximately 50 million neurons, okay? And so we can take this structure, we can lay it out, stretch it out like this, and we can take these neurons, and let's imagine that there's a handful of neurons here, a small number of neurons that are changed by experience. And these neurons, then, we look at the entire array of the hippocampus, these neurons are going to disappear amidst the millions of neurons that lie within this structure. So if we're poking around, trying to find the cells that have been changed, it's going to be a long day. Sometimes we might get lucky, and in fact, in some cases, there have been some really astonishing discoveries about how specific neurons can be in representing a very specific visual stimulus or memory. And so I'm going to tell you about one more study in humans before I move on to what has been done in the mouse. And that is a study that was done at UCLA by Kwan Kiroga. Again, looking at patients, a patient who was a candidate for surgery. He was going to have, he was epileptic, and he was going to have some resection of this epileptic focus in his brain. But prior to his surgery, he had electrodes implanted in his brain so that his doctors could determine where the abnormally active portion of the brain was. Okay? And in that time, some neurophysiologists came to talk to him and began to do some experiments looking at some of the data, some of the responses of neurons. Now, these are neurons in a living person, right? And these neurons are responding to specific stimuli. And what they did with this patient, he's in bed for a week. You know, they've got to collect some data, see what looks normal, what looks abnormal. And they're recording neural activity, and they're recording the spikes that neurons generate. So many of you may know that neurons are excitable cells, and neurons communicate with each other through something called a spike or an action potential. And our neurons are active all the time. Not every neuron is firing at every second, but many neurons are firing, and it seems to be the combination of spikes and groups of neurons that are responsible for thought and for our experience, for our recollection, and for our ability to move, for volition, as well as our experiences of hunger, of our experiences of thirst, our experiences of calculus or regret, okay? And so it's the spiking properties of neurons which they were recording during these experiments. And what these investigators decided to do was to show this person a number of images. So this, again, is some sort of visual recollection. And in showing this person thousands of images and recording from, so they're recording from the hippocampus, they have electrodes placed, and they're actually embedded in the brain. They're very, very tiny wires laid down across different portions of the brain, because they don't want to make a mistake. They don't want to take out any healthy tissue. They only want to take out tissue that's behaving abnormally. And then they began to show this person images, hundreds and hundreds of images, while collecting the activity of these neurons, to try to see if there was anything in particular that they could relate the activity of one neuron to as a stimulus. And here's what they found. They found a cell that loved to respond to Jennifer Aniston. And so they could show this guy a picture of Jennifer Aniston in any direction, a profile shot, a head shot, right? Even the words Jennifer Aniston would cause this neuron to fire action potentials. And so I'm showing you down here some of the images that they used of Jennifer Aniston. Here's Jennifer Aniston in a number of different settings. Sometimes you're really close to her face, sometimes you're much further away. And this down here, these blue lines represent the spikes, the action potentials that were elicited by this neuron. And what you can see is, this is a summary then. If you take all these spikes and pile them on top of each other, they become these black bars. This is a histogram, a peristimulus time histogram. And you can see that the neuron, before they flash the image is flashed in between these two dotted lines. Before they flash the image, the neuron fires maybe once in a while, or maybe not. They show the image of Jennifer Aniston, and the neuron goes crazy. The image goes away, and then the neuron quietens down a little bit. Okay? They show another image of Jennifer Aniston. Her hair is pulled back. She looks totally different. The neuron fires and then stops. They show a picture of Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt. So this was before Angelina Jolie. Okay, so this is dating the study a little bit. They show the patient a picture of Angelina of Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston, and the cell does not respond very well. The cell really likes Jennifer Aniston and only Jennifer Aniston. So, you know, first, from a scientific point of view, these are heroic experiments, right? Because you have a very short window of time to collect this data. This guy's in the hospital, he's going to have surgery. You have about a week. You have about 5 days, okay? And you're going to be showing these images. You've got a, by the way, you've got a number of electrodes in the brain, right? You probably have, you're collecting the activity of 50 to 100 neurons. And you don't know, you're not monitoring those 50 neurons when you're presenting each of these images. So you present a bunch of images, you collect the data, you run back to the lab, analyze everything, see if there's anything interesting, and then maybe the next day you try to figure out another set of images in which to test. Okay, so they didn't discover, they didn't have 50,000 images of Jennifer Aniston to start with. And they happened to find an image that this neuron really liked. Now let me show you some things that the neuron didn't like, right? We have a bunch of different movie stars here. We have the Eiffel Tower. We have spiders and snakes. Incredibly specific for Jennifer Aniston. And what this suggests is that our ability to remember things can be localized, can be associated with the activity of a small number of cells. Now, 50 million cells, what are the chances that they found the one cell that was responsive to Jennifer Aniston? I think what that means is that there must have been more than one. But it does mean that not all cells are doing the job, and it means that cells are very specific in the kinds of memories that they participate in. So, I'm going to start talking a little bit now about some of the work that I am involved in, looking at how connections between neurons or synapses are changed by experience. And in this case, we're going to focus now not on the hippocampus, in part because the hippocampus is enormous and we can't figure out what part of it we should be looking at. There's just too many cells. So if I want to understand what's required to create a memory, I want to start off by thinking about cells, about neurons, and I want to think about what's required for neurons to communicate with each other, and those are the connections between neurons called synapses. And so this is an example of a synapse here. This is neurons are incredibly elaborate structures. They have inputs. They might have 10,000 inputs, and they might send out 10,000 outputs. So if we have 100 billion neurons, if there's 100 billion neurons in your brain, and each one of those has 10,000 synapses, we've got around 10 to the 15th synapses in our brain. That's not as many stars are in the universe, right? Just by the way, that's probably on the order of 10 to the 24th. So we're still, and that's probably an underestimate, right? So we're still way off stars in the universe. But there's a lot of synapses. And if we think that learning is occurring at specific synapses, and there's 10 to the 15th synapses, then we have to get a better idea of where we want to look before we start, because we're not going to screen through 10 to the 15th synapses. Okay? So finding the right neurons and finding the right synapses that have been changed is a big challenge. And I would argue this is a schematic of a neuron, right? These here represent the dendrites, which is where information is coming into these neurons. And these neurons here may spike or they may not spike, depending upon whether those inputs are strong enough to overcome their natural resting potential in order to elicit a response. Okay, so here's our strategy. We want to work with a smaller brain, because a human brain, first of all, there's some problems in me taking your brain and doing something with it. There's also too many neurons. Quite frankly, I think I would rather work with something a little bit less complex. We need a smaller brain, and I think we need a different brain area. The hippocampus is just too large. There's good evidence that the hippocampus is involved in memory, but it's not the only place. And remember, Wilder Penfield was stimulating, in fact, the cortex, the neocortex. We want to be able to use genetic manipulations and the kinds of things you can do in rodents in the 21st century, the kind of genetic manipulations where you can identify specific genes that might be involved, where you can express specific proteins that will glow green or red or yellow, where you can manipulate the activity of neurons using light, for example, or designer chemicals that would never normally be found in a brain, is truly extraordinary. And those tools are really going to be what gives us a foothold into asking these very specific questions about the biological mechanisms of memory. And then we want to look at the strength of connections between specific cells. So we want to find the cells, and then we want to see how those cells have changed their response properties. Sorry. So, Homo sapiens, 100 billion neurons. A mouse, 100 million neurons. Sounds better, right? We could, in fact, work with the fruit fly, right, which is probably buzzing around. It's been so warm lately, right? It's probably buzzing around your incinerator or your fruit bowl right now. The fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, has been a workhorse of the biological sciences, and there have been multiple Nobel Prizes that have been awarded for work that have been done in this lowly organism. Its brain has about 100,000 neurons, and in fact, Drosophila exhibits incredibly complex and learned behaviors. However, this is pretty distant from us. On the other hand, rodents are very close. And the general structure of their cortex, of their neocortex and their hippocampus, is almost exactly the same as ours. So I'm going to focus on the mouse. And I'm going to focus, in order to try to find the neurons that are encoding memory, I'm going to focus, so here's, this is to scale here, this is a mouse brain. It's about the size of the tip of your pinky finger, right? It's pretty small. But, right, I mean, this is much more manageable. And I'm going to focus on a different type of memory, right? So, you know, Jennifer Aniston, great, right? You can all recognize Jennifer Aniston. But there are other kinds of memory, there are other kinds of ways that experience can transform the brain. So this is Yo-Yo Ma here, who's an expert cello player. And he's clearly learned, right, how to move and how to move his fingers in such a way to create a beautiful sound from this instrument. This is our mouse here, who's eating a cookie. But there's a lot of things that mice can learn how to do. We're not going to have them play the cello, but we can get them to do some very simple and straightforward things, like, for example, conditioned taste avoidance, which is an absolutely fascinating form of memory, right? Everybody's had this experience where you've eaten something and you felt sick afterwards, probably as a kid, right? And you didn't want to eat that again. And some of you, it might be 20 years before you ate that again. Incredibly robust form of memory. One of the really interesting things about it is that, you know, normally with memory, something happens and you can, you know, it, like there's a cause and an effect and you remember, oh, this happened and it was followed by, you link two things by their temporal association. With conditioned taste avoidance, the interval between what you ate and when you got sick can be hours. And the only thing you associate with getting sick, it's not the music you were listening to. It's not the color of the car that you were driving in. It's not the time of day. Was it night or was it morning? It's not the room you were sitting in. It's the food. It's very, very specific. And that long time interval is fascinating. One trial, that's all you need. You didn't need to get sick four times. You got sick once. And you remember it for 20 years. Now that's, gosh, that would be a great memory. I mean, if it wasn't conditioned taste avoidance. But there's a lot of things we can do to mice. And so we're going to ask not where are the neurons that encode memory? We're going to make this a simpler question. We're going to ask, where are the neurons that are changed by experience? Okay? And I'm going to focus on somatosensory cortex. So this is a schematic of the human brain here. This is the temporal lobe here. The eyes would be up front here. This is the visual cortex in the back of the head. And the somatosensory cortex lies here. It's encoded in yellow. Now, one of the nice things about the somatosensory cortex, remember, I'm trying to make the problem simpler. I want fewer neurons. I want to know where to look. I want to know what cells so that I can know how they're changed. So there's somatosensory cortex. If we sort of zoom in on this, we take a cross-section of this, you can see this arrangement of this map that corresponds to the body surface. And so if you can read this, it might be small for some of you in the back, but you have, this is the midline here, okay? And you start off with the genitals right along the midline, the toes, which are right next to the genitals, the foot, the leg, you have the neck, the head, shoulder, arms, hand, fingers, thumb, eye, nose, face, lips, and then you move into the oral cavity, teeth, tongue, pharynx, and viscera. And so this now is a schematic that really depicts in size what's the area of the representation like. So the hands are huge, the lips and tongue are huge, right? The elbow's really tiny, okay? But the representation here is a map. It's a topographic map of the body surface. And so because I know that there's this orderly arrangement here, if I do something like stimulate the big the thumb here, I can know roughly where to look here. I'm going to go to this part of the cortex to look for where these sorts of experience-dependent changes in neural function might lie. Now, why do I think that studying somatosensation is going to help me? Why does that have anything to do with memory? And I told you about some forms of perceptual learning, right? You know, it seems like you can learn how to recognize a male from a female chick, right? That's pretty cool, right? But there are other forms of tactile learning, and it looks like they're really specific. So you can train somebody. This is a vibration discrimination task. You train on a hand, and you're training this finger right here, finger zero, okay? And you train them, the individuals, to detect or discriminate between this tactile stimulus. And then you ask them, can they do it on the next finger? And can they do it on the next finger? And it turns out they're not so good at doing it on adjacent fingers. They're really good at this finger. It translates a little bit to the next finger and poorly to the third finger. And that suggests that there's a location in the somatotopic map and that we might be able to find it. Okay, so how are we going to do this in rodents? Well, I'm not going to study the hands in rodents. It turns out what rodents really have an enormous representation of. Let's go back. So this is our human here, right? We have huge representation for the hands, huge representation for the lips and mouth. The largest representation in the rodent is the whiskers, is the facial whiskers. So any of you who has a pet, when you go home tonight, I want you to take a look at your cat or your dog, and you see that they have a giant whiskers. Right? There are whiskers above the eyes, on the ears. There's a halo of hairs around their head. These are incredibly sensitive tactile devices. In fact, we still don't know what animals are doing with these. They can use them to detect, for example, texture, but they're probably using them to detect other sort of complex cues in their environment. In a mouse, and a dog, and a cat, these whiskers aren't like our whiskers or our eyebrows, right? Where we have thousands of hairs in all sorts of arrangements. They're so stereotyped that you can give them a name. And so you could name this whisker. This whisker here is the A, this is the A1 whisker, A2, A3, A4. And you can actually move all the way across the face and identify each whisker. And then you can look at the surface of the brain and you can see that same map in exactly the same orientation. And so here you can see A1, A2, A3, A4. And you can then use that to do something to one whisker and then go into the brain and sift through those 100 million neurons and find the few thousand or so that represent that one part that you were stimulating. So this is a painting that actually was made by one of my students with a mouse here that has only one whisker, and it's overlaid on top of this topographic map of the whisker somatosensory cortex, and she's highlighted this one region that has been activated by the stimulation of that whisker. And we have taken advantage of one property that's been long understood about learning, which is that during learning, new genes are turned on. So neurons, cells that are activated and during learning, the learning process, new genes have to be expressed. And so we can track, we can find those one in a million by coupling that gene expression to a fluorescent protein, to a green fluorescent protein. And the green fluorescent protein has been a workhorse of biology. Cells that make this protein will glow green when you shine light of an appropriate wavelength on them. You don't need to do anything else. They can be alive, and you can see those cells. And then you can study the properties of those cells. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take this whisker pad here. We're going to stimulate one whisker, and we're going to see if we can find some green cells in that representation. So this is now a cross-section, a coronal cross-section taken like this, of the mouse cortex, and this is the cortex. The mouse cortex is lissencephalic. It's smooth, right? It doesn't have the Celsian gyri that we have. But, you know, they have 1,000 times fewer neurons, right? There's got to be a place, you know, it's not just the size. It's also in the convolutions where you get to add some of that that surface area. And this column right here, where you see these green cells, represents that one whisker that was stimulated. And so these FOS-GFP transgenic mice enable us to identify those that area, that small brain area, that's been changed by some experience. So how has it been changed? These are Wilder Penfield's words. He suggested that it was tempting to believe that a synaptic facilitation established by the original experience, which guided the succession of impulses, would later then activate that pattern through one connection after another, producing recollection. And he said, and this was in 1951, that it was obvious that years of study would be needed to define synaptic facilitation's nature. And I would say we're 60 years later, and we're just beginning to get a handle on it. Okay? So here's the experiment that we do. We'll take an animal and stimulate just one whisker. And after one day, so here's what we see. We see this part of the brain like this. And after just one day, we'll ask, are there changes in the properties of synapses between neurons in this brain area? And we're going to do this by recording from stimulating an input and recording from a neuron in this brain area. And we're going to investigate. So, in fact, in this case, there's an input from one set of neurons. We're going to be recording from this neuron here. And we're going to ask whether those inputs are bigger or smaller or whether they stay the same. And I would say that, you know, it's difficult for a lay audience to convey exactly what kind of data we collect. And I think really most of biology, most of science really can be boiled down to, does it get bigger or does it get smaller or does it not change? And I think really that's the question you should be asking, right? I mean, that's the simplest way to see, is there an effect? What's the effect? And so this, what I'm showing you here, is an electrical response of a neuron to a stimulus, and you're stimulating an input to the cell, and you can see the size of this input. And that's what it typically looks like in a normal animal where you haven't done anything in particular. And now in an animal where you've had this single whisker that's been stimulated, you can survey, you can assay the strength of this response, and what we found was that this response got a lot bigger. It gets bigger by about 20 to 30%. The amplitude of this input gets bigger. And what that means is that this neuron is much more likely, with stronger inputs, it's much more likely to fire action potentials or to fire more action potentials. And you can create now a network of neurons that are linked by some common experience using these mechanisms of synaptic potentiation, of synaptic strengthening. And you can, in fact, look at brain areas where you haven't had any input stimulation, and you can look at the strength of those inputs there, and they remain unchanged. And so the strengthening that we're seeing in one in a million neurons, right? There's literally a few thousand neurons in this brain area, and we can find a tiny number of cells in the entire mouse brain that have been changed by this short duration of experience. Now, we've been able to use this preparation to start to crack open some of the molecular and pharmacological tools that we could use to manipulate memory. And I'm just going to show you one more experiment here where we looked at how are these changes in synaptic strength, how do they happen? And we thought that, you know, they would slowly increase over time. Just like, for example, you know, if you're learning how to do something, if you're learning how to play the piano and you practice every day, you get a little bit better and a little bit better, right? Practice improves your capacity for remembering things. And we started to look at these very early stages of synaptic strengthening. And we saw that after just a few hours, these synapses were getting bigger. And after 12 hours, they were, in fact, a lot bigger. And as we then continued to look at later and later stages of this whisker stimulation input, we saw that the synapses themselves began to get smaller. They're still bigger than they were, but they started to shrink. And in fact, one of the things that my lab at Carnegie Mellon has done has been to define the molecules that are required for these different phases of learning. Now, it turns out that the same phenomenon, the same processes that we see in this tiny part of the mouse brain that represents the whiskers, and who cares about the whiskers? We don't have whiskers. Do we care if these animals can do something new and different with their whiskers, if their whiskers are more sensitive? Chicken sexing, maybe, but I mean, you know, whiskers, what good is that? But these basic mechanisms by which synapses become stronger are used not only in this part of the brain, but they're used in many other parts of the brain as well. The difference is that we were able to discover them because we knew where to look. And that has been the key in using then using these principles to understand memory encoding in other parts of the brain. So I'm going to leave you, particularly I want you to think about this here, this period of synaptic weakening. What is it about newly strengthened synapses that makes them labile? Okay? And in fact, this principle appears to be very useful in treating some sorts of memory disorders. So now when we talk about memory disorders, you're probably thinking of things like, oh, I can't remember where I put my keys, or, you know, my mother has Alzheimer's disease. And those are certainly memory disorders. But there's other types of memory disorders that are equally debilitating. And one of those is post-traumatic stress disorder, right? Where you can remember something and you can't forget, and it becomes paralyzing. And in fact, by understanding some of the basic principles by which synapses become stronger, we can also start to understand some of the principles by which we can erase those changes. And so in fact, the student who did some of this work in my lab, looking at the basic properties of how sensory experience could transform synapses, then went on to examine whether these same principles would be happening in a part of the brain that encodes fear memories. And in fact, he discovered that the same principles were active. And by taking advantage of what we knew about these stages of synaptic strengthening and weakening, he could use those principles to, in fact, erase fear memories by selective reactivation of that memory. Okay, I'm going to leave you with some of the outstanding questions that we have in the field. There's been a tremendous interest on understanding the molecules that are involved. And maybe, you know, maybe some of us have a mutation in one of these molecules. Maybe that's why I can't remember anything. It turns out that there's so many different genes involved in memory. In fact, probably they all need to be working together. That means there's a lot of compensation, but it also means that you're not going to find one that's sort of the super controller. Okay? And we've gotten really caught up in what's going on at molecular detail, but there's a number of processes that we really don't understand, and I think the next 10 or 20 years are going to focus much more on these processes. Is there an anatomical place for short-term versus long-term memory? And how do we move them from one site to another? So remember I told you about HM? Now, when he had his hippocampus removed, he could no longer make new memories, but he could remember all sorts of things that happened before that operation. Those memories are not, they don't stay in the same place. Is everything encoded? If somebody hypnotized you, would you be able to remember what the person sitting next to you was wearing 2 weeks on Saturday? Are we encoding everything? I mean, can we saturate the ability of our brains to encode information? We'd like to know how synapses maintain these molecular changes. Right? Perhaps that would give us some way to augment them if we could stabilize something. And one of the final questions I want to leave you with is, single neurons by themselves are not going to encode memories. Just because one neuron fires in response to an image of Jennifer Aniston doesn't mean that the memory is in that neuron. There are probably chains of neurons communicating with each other in sequence, and that is how the memory is reconstructed in our experience. We know parts of the brain that are likely to be involved. We know how specific connections can be changed. But in between that, in the richness of our experience, in the 100 billion neurons in our brain, there's a lot of room for us to understand how that experience is encoded. And I'm going to leave you with just a picture of my students who carried out this work. This is Roger Klun, who's now on the faculty at Mount Sinai in New York, Jing Wen, who's a postdoc at Carnegie Mellon, and Mark DeBlow, who's a student at UC Davis in California. Thanks very much.